Good morning, and thank you all for coming on this wintry day. We've got a great group here this morning. Joel Barkin, a recent arrival here as a senior associate with CSIS, is going to be Master of Ceremonies. I want to thank also Tristan and Elizabeth for putting a lot of effort into production of papers for this. There's a couple of different handouts. There's two by Catherine Southwick, which are more recent arrivals that I want to make sure that you all have a chance to pick up. They're out on the table in the back. There's a piece that Tristan put together, an excellent piece that's also back there, a chronology. Joel, you want to do the honors?
Yeah, thank you very much, Steve. Thank you all for coming, and thank you also, Tristan, for preparing the background paper. And the reprints of some recent writings by Catherine and Johnny P., did you bring yours as well? You're an indefatigable pamphleteer. We hope that everybody gets their word out this morning. Today's topic, the elusive search for peace in northern Uganda, a search that's taken place now for almost 19 years, to bring to an end a conflict of unspeakable atrocities and suffering that is arguably as serious and tragic as the conflict in Darfur. Yet unlike Darfur, the war has so far failed to attract the same level of attention on the part of the international community, including the United States, as well as the European Union and the UN. And I think one of the purposes of this meeting this morning and others that we plan to hold as part of a program, a new program on East African security and governance that's being mounted here at CSIS, will revisit Uganda as well as the other countries of the region in the next few months. All of the international players are aware of the complexities of the conflict, but none have so far invested significant resources or political conflict to end it. Indeed, the United States regards the LRA as a terrorist organization and provides non-lethal assistance and other assistance to the government of Uganda to hunt down the LRA. The United States also supports, via USAID, the Northern Uganda Peace Initiative, or NUPI as it's known, to support reconciliation among the combatants. And the United States, together with the Netherlands, Norway, and the United Kingdom, has supported the efforts by today's featured speaker to mediate an end to the conflict. The war has now resulted in the deaths of up to 90,000 people, most of whom are Acholi, and the displacement of between 1.2 and 1.6 million people from their homes. The war has resulted in widespread immiseration across the north, where it has affected 12 of Uganda's 56 administrative districts, and now threatens the viability, if not the actual survival, of the Acholi people. While mainly a conflict between the government of Uganda and the Lord's Resistance Army, the conflict is actually a complicated struggle that has played itself out on four dimensions, between the Uganda People's Defense Force and the LRA rebels, between the LRA and the wider Acholi population who have been the principal victims of the war. It has also been a political conflict between the ruling NRM regime in Uganda, which is mainly a regime of southerners against the north, or at least that's the way it is perceived by many northerners, and the north, because the north was the political base of previous governments in Uganda prior to the assumption of power by the NRM. And finally, it was until 2001, a proxy war between Uganda and Sudan in which both countries' governments supported each other's rebel groups. It is also a war that seemingly defies settlement for a host of reasons, several of which will be the focus of the discussion this morning. Our featured speaker, as you know, is Betty Bigombe, and we're delighted to have Betty here. I must say I've been pursuing her for this for how long, but she slips off to Uganda, and therefore it's been difficult to have her come. But she is here with us prior to returning to Uganda tomorrow night. And her efforts in this to mediate an end to this conflict, as many of you know, have spanned a period almost as long as the war itself. Betty is presently chief mediator between the government of Uganda and the Lord's Resistance Army. She is also a senior consultant at the World Bank, where she is attached to the Social Protection Unit within the African region and is currently providing technical support to orphans and other vulnerable children in Burundi. Betty received her BA from Makerere University in Uganda in 1976, where she majored in literature, sociology, and rural economy. She then spent a number of years working in the 1980s for the Uganda Mining Corporation, for the African Development Bank, and eventually left during the worst of the Amin years for Japan and was out of the country for a period of time. She joined the Museveni government in 1986 upon its assumption of power, first as deputy minister in the office of the prime minister, and then from 1988 to 1996 as a full cabinet minister, during which time she was charged with the responsibility of ending the rebellion in the north and northeastern Uganda by peaceful means. She situated herself in the north. Her offices were there. She worked tirelessly with traditional leaders, with local leaders, and with ordinary people in order to mediate the conflict, and came very close to doing so in 1994. But then, as a result of distrust and a variety of factors, the agreement was not consummated, and the war resumed. Ms. Bigambe left government in 1996 at the time of the first contested elections for parliament to spend 2 years at the JFK School at Harvard, from which she received a master's degree in 1997, and she then joined the World Bank as a senior consultant, as I've already mentioned. With the assent of President Museveni and the LRA, both of whom she has maintained contact with over the years, Ms. Bigambe resumed her efforts to mediate the conflict during the second half of 2004, an effort that nearly brought the war to an end on December 31st of that year, but which failed at the last minute when the rebels requested more time to consider the government's proposals and the government declared the then ceasefire over. Despite subsequent efforts to clarify government proposals over the past year, the negotiations dwindled after May to the point that they are now arguably at a stalemate. Nonetheless, Betty continues her efforts to mediate the peace. She's returning to Uganda tonight, as I already indicated. And at this point, without further ado, I will turn the floor over to her. Betty will speak for approximately 20 to 25 minutes, and then we will proceed with presentations by John Prendergast of the International Crisis Group and Catherine Southwick, and then, of course, open it up for discussion. So Betty, welcome to CSIS.
Thank you very much, Joel, and thank you to all of you for coming here and showing interest in the crisis in northern Uganda. In my presentation, I will touch on the historical aspect of the conflict, because I believe that is important in understanding which way we are going. Since time is very, very little, I will simply touch on that and then tell you a little bit about the situation in 2004, which, as Joel has told you, got us quite close to ending the war, and then the current situation after the ICC issued the arrest warrant and other developments, and then possibly recommendations as to what the international community can do, what the U.S. government can do, and the U.N., and other actors. The historical context, I would like to argue that the role of tribalism, and I deliberately avoid using the word ethnicity, should not be ruled out nor exaggerated in the war in northern Uganda. That immediately takes us to the relationship between the NRM government, the National Resistance Movement government, led by President Museveni, and the people of Acholi in particular. During Obote I and both Obote II, the Acholi people dominated the army. This goes back to the colonial days, when jobs were portioned off. That is, Northerners were fighters and therefore dominated the armed forces. That is, the police, the army, and prison. While one section of the country, Webaganda, they were supposed to go to school and make become civil servants. But when Museveni went into the bush to fight Obote II government, Acholi dominated that army. And therefore, when Museveni came to power, there was a lot of suspicion immediately. They were looked as the bad people, and they, on the one hand, considered themselves as the people who led the war against Museveni. Then came the coup of 1985 by Tito Okello. The coup of 1985 by Tito Okello, he stayed in power for only 6 months, and within that period, he tried to negotiate with Museveni so that there could be so as to end the war and also have an inclusive government. Now, this is called the Nairobi Peace Talks in 1985. Unfortunately, it was signed. Everybody was happy. But when Museveni marched into Kampala, shut his way into power in 1986, January, the Acholis felt betrayed. How could he not honor an agreement that he was a signatory to? And that immediately created suspicion. And, of course, there were also other factors that, although it was not government policy to punish the Acholis, but a lot of people took it upon themselves to burn houses, attack individuals, and coupled with that, there were people who lost jobs, who were thrown out of their homes, and certainly a lot of people found themselves vulnerable. It was like they had nowhere to go anymore. So, and furthermore, the Acholis had been targeted by Idi Amin in the 70s when Idi Amin came to power, and for the same reason that this is a tribe that has dominated the army. So they became his target immediately. And as things evolved and they thought Amin was going to be a president, they put away their guns, but they became targets, and they felt they could not put away their guns anymore. There was no reason for them to trust Mr. Museveni. After all, he had already betrayed the peace accord. So these are some of the suspicions. This is some of the relationship that needs to be understood between the government of Uganda and the Acholi people. I would also like to say in here that it cannot also be conclusively demonstrated that the origin of the insurgency was a reaction to NRM abuse of human rights when it assumed state power. In fact, when you look at it, elements of the Okello's regime when it was overthrown from government and the Uganda National Liberation Army, almost without a pause, made transition from the National Army into an insurgency group in 1986 when Museveni came into power. So they did not give the National Resistance Government opportunity to prove itself, whether it was willing to reconcile with the different groups. It simply went into the bush, picked up arms to overthrow the government. So within 6 months of the National Resistance Movement in power, there were two factions in Acholi alone that picked up arms to overthrow the government and recapture state power. And that was the Uganda People's Democratic Army / Movement and Alice Lakwena's Holy Spirit Mobile Force. Alice Lakwena's Mobile Force was defeated in 1987, while UPDA, or Uganda People's Democratic Army / M, movement negotiated with government and signed peace agreement in December of 1987. Now, Khoinsloth's resistance army was formed towards 1987. It emerged out of the remnants of UPDA and Alice Lakwena. The speed at which Alice Lakwena's army was destroyed, it gave a lot of confidence to the Ugandan army then. And they simply sat back and thought any replay of the Holy Spirit War would meet with the same fate as that of Alice Lakwena. So when Khoin came and formed his Lord's resistance army, he was not taken seriously. In fact, it took time before the Ugandan army started fighting the Lord's resistance army seriously, and after having suffered some humiliation defeat at the in the hands of the Lord's resistance army, that in about 1989, that it started taking the LRA seriously. As you probably would all know, there have been several attempts to end the conflict by peaceful means. This is after persuading the president, because President Museveni has always called LRA just a bandit group. It's just a small group, and probably has tried to ignore their impact in the war. There was the Bigombe One initiative in the 90s, which Joel talked about. There was the Carter Center initiative. There was the Presidential Peace Team in 2001, 2002. And then there was a Acholi Religious Leaders Peace Initiative. And now you have the Bigombe Two initiative. The challenge in 2004 was to persuade the president to give me opportunity to mediate between the government and the Lord's Resistance Army, was what incentives were there to get him to accept it. After so many years declaring that the war was finished, after so many years giving deadlines that in 2 months' time the war would be over, and yet the war dragged on. So what was there that I was going to offer that which was going to persuade him, after all these initiatives have not succeeded, that I should have another chance to negotiate? In the same vein, I was faced with the same situation with LRA. What is there? What incentives are there? Because they kept on saying, well, we are not defeated. We cannot take amnesty. So those were the challenges. The other thing was Sudan, as you all heard, was a key player. What was there to get Sudan to stop giving support to LRA in 2004 when I started this initiative? So it took telling President Museveni, using some rationale and saying, look, you've succeeded in this area and that area. What if you look at the economy? What if you had these 1.6 million people being productive? How much more impact would it have had? Not only that, having achieved so much in other areas, how about opting for a peaceful solution as opposed to military solution per se? You'll go down in history. You could easily be another Mandela. And simply try to be more sensitive to the suffering of the people of Acholi. Look at yourself as a father. What would it take if your children were abducted by LRA and abused? So that went down well, I think. And he agreed, and I started off with Sudan and made contact with LRA. Finally, to cut the long story short, September, I was back in Uganda from here. Now, we want to look at the results of the process in 2004. Certainly, the peace process yielded several important results to date, including the first meeting between government of Uganda and the Lord's Resistance Army in December of 2004, which brought us quite close to signing a ceasefire agreement. a number of ceasefires between the two parties to the conflict were declared. Several confidence-building meetings took place. In fact, accompanied by members of the international community, from November to January, we had already 10 meetings with LRA. And in that process included local leaders. That included the religious leaders as well as the cultural leaders. The period also saw defection of high-level LRA commanders, which further weakened LRA. And my hope was that in itself, the defection itself, would encourage them, would propel them, close, will encourage them to go to the table and talk peace. Not only that, we also saw a decrease in the number of attacks and ambushes on civilians during the period of mediation. Unfortunately, there have not been very many activities since March, although contact with LRA has continued. And again, in here, I look back and regret very much that I picked up direct contact with Cogne when his chief negotiator defected in March. And we talked on a daily basis, and I got him to talk to members of his family until we reached a point that there should be a meeting between us on the 20th of April 2005. Unfortunately, government declined to give permission for that meeting to take place. So since then, you would say contacts continue. Contact continue with LRA on the phone, but no meaningful meetings have taken place since then. Of course, now, as I speak, we have a completely different situation in that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has issued an arrest warrant, which further complicates the situation. The recent incursion of LRA into the Democratic Republic of Congo, which gives the conflict now a regional dimension. And the most recent killing of peacekeepers, MONUC, in Congo, further makes the situation very difficult. But even with that, I still absolutely insist that the dialogue with LRA should continue. A lot of people ask me questions. What can you talk to a group that does not have any political agenda? What can you talk to a group that has all this spiritual belief that the leadership has contact with God? While LRA is one of the most difficult and brutal groups to deal with, there's still important need to keep the dialogue option open to end the conflict as quickly as possible. At the moment, you have the military. You have multiple tracks to end the conflict. The military option is continuous and has never stopped, except during the ceasefire seasons. The amnesty law to facilitate return of LRA combatants and commanders is still also in force, and the peace process. In my opinion, dialogue can persuade the non-indicted commanders to come out. And indeed, since ICC issued the arrest warrant, the strategy has changed in that how can we get the non-indicted commanders to talk? That, of course, means you still have to maintain contact with Cogne or the indictees to persuade them to allow the non-indicted commanders to go on with the peace talks. Furthermore, the strategy is what is there that the non-indictees would be attracted to talks? We have looked at what is going on at the moment in northern Uganda, that we have so many LRAs who have defected. You have hundreds and thousands of child mothers. You have thousands of child soldiers. You have thousands of so-called senior commanders who are out. But you do not have any program that to address their needs, to give them a means of livelihood. Talking to commanders who are out, they also tell you that there are many who want to come out. We're really tired. We see no end to the war. We see no cause to it. But what is there for them to come out to? When you who are out do not have any program to rehabilitate you, to give you a means of livelihood, Not only that, when there is nothing to turn the child mothers or child soldiers to become productive members of the community. So in looking at this mediation or negotiation, if you will, is also trying to see package in other programs that make it attractive, that gives LRA incentives either to defect or the non-indictees to come out and talk. I also believe that military victory alone will not bring sustainable peace. It will be a defeat. I think through dialogue, it will also give the Acholi people opportunity to reconcile with government, to be able to address some of the underlying causes of the problem. Because for UPDF enjoyed support, so did Alice Lakwena, so did the Lord's Resistance Army. Why did they enjoy that support? It's because the Acholi people feel they are a marginalized people. And I believe it's through talks, through some kind of dialogue, that that some of the underlying causes of the conflict will be addressed. I also believe that to engage them in talks will help in building confidence, both with LRA as well as with the people, the community who are outside. And it will help us to pursue a possible exit strategy for ending the conflict. So with the consent of Uganda government and also the consent of now a new player, ICC, I maintain contact with both the leadership and the other indictees, purposely to be able to persuade them to allow some talks to continue. Now, some people might ask why post-ICC would talks be relevant. As I said earlier, engaging CONI is important to allow, in some ways, without using the word surrender, I'm also talking to them that instead of being hunted down, I offer this opportunity for them to consider going to The Hague, since they've always insisted that it is Uganda government that has been tarnishing their image. They're innocent. They've not been abducting. They've not been killing. I try to persuade them that The Hague offers them opportunity to go and defend themselves and prove to the world that they're innocent people without necessarily using the word surrender. And elaborate on the kind of entitlements they have, that they're free to hire, they will have lawyers. And should they be found guilty, there's also no death sentence. Whereas if the option of staying in Uganda or being hunted down, chances of being killed is very high. So this is the kind of engagement and persuading him to allow talks to go with the non-indictees, which at the moment he has allowed. It's just that we've not been able to put it together. Each time we've tried, something has gone down. Recently, when they made a move, for talks, the response was that this is a dry season. The dry season in northern Uganda, grass is all burned down, and it's very difficult to fight. I mean, it's very difficult for LRA to conceal themselves. So usually they take advantage of that by asking that they want talks. So we've decided we'll wait and show, let them demonstrate their seriousness when the dry season ends. I also continue to tell them that the only way they can convince people that they're serious about talks is if they can declare unilateral ceasefire, because they've never really reciprocated the ceasefire that the government gave. So I tell them that that is important. Now, given this current situation, I've told you the contact continues because the dialogue will provide a chance to influence the rebels. Now, what can the international community do? First of all, the international community has ignored this war for a long, long, long time. And some of us have always wondered why there's so much attention to DRC and not northern Uganda. Since the conflict, since LRA relocated to DRC, you now have a regional dimension that needs to be addressed. There's threat to stability in the region. The continued attacks by LRA on the people of southern Sudan, the people of DRC, and people of northern Uganda is a source for worry. But furthermore, I see a situation where Congo is extremely worried that Uganda may use the presence of LRA in DRC to invade DRC. So there's a lot of nervousness. There's heightened suspicion at the moment between DRC and Congo. Not only that, how will the peace agreement in Sudan, southern Sudan, be implemented when you have LRA roaming all over southern Sudan? This is not going to be possible. So it is very important that the international community keeps the conflict in northern Uganda visible. It is true that LRA has been weakened, but this is not the first time LRA gets weakened. They have always regrouped and come back. Why would I want, for example, United States to get more involved? To a point that I would even ask that the special envoy of the U.S. to Sudan could easily cover northern Uganda. The war in Sudan and northern Uganda are so intertwined. In fact, to a large extent, the war in northern Uganda was a hostage of the war in Sudan. If you look at it carefully, the U.S. and the international community have invested heavily in peace in Sudan. Are they ready to let it slip off because LRA is a group that you cannot talk to? Certainly, something can be done that to ensure that they stop. Furthermore, you have the future of Uganda, the suffering of people, retarded economic and political development in the region, and humanitarian reasons, high mortality rates in the camps, second only to DRC in the entire world, and the destruction of a tribe. I just don't think the world should stop by and say, well, ICC has already issued an arrest warrant, and therefore we cannot do anything else. There are certain avenues that can be explored to help bring the war to an end. I'm being told it's already time. I also strongly advocate for the presence for a special envoy of the UN a special envoy for northern Uganda from the UN. Again, here it will make the issue visible and people will pay more attention to the suffering of the people and make a lot of effort to see how the war can be ended. And we need patience with the dialogue, because it's true, LRA is a very difficult group to talk to. There's the spiritual element that I'm now trying to understand and see how it can be factored into the mediation. But We need a lot of patience. I'll say what I've said somewhere else when a Norwegian diplomat, I think, was asked the three most important games of mediation. He said one was patience, two, patience, three, patience. We need to be very, very patient and understand the situation and try to, and explore the best way to bring it to a quick, peaceful solution, sustainable, peaceful solution. Thank you.
Betty, thank you very much. And because you turned to the topic of the special envoy and the questions of the effectiveness of that approach, our next speaker, very appropriately on that is John Prendergast, who's been one of the main advocates for a special envoy to deal with the conflict in northern Uganda. Most of you know Johnny P., as we call him. He is a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group, who has spent more than most of his 20-year career focusing on issues of conflict resolution and human rights in Africa. John was a director for Africa at the NSC during the Clinton administration and featured prominently in President Clinton's trip to Africa in 1998, a visit that included Uganda because Yoweri Museveni at that time was designated as one of the new leaders of the continent. Over the last 2 to 3 years, he has arguably done as much or more than any other American to bring the conflicts in Darfur and northern Uganda to the public's attention by traveling repeatedly to the affected regions, by writing periodic op-ed pieces and other essays, and by appearing on television on several prominent programs such as ABC's Nightline and CNN. And some of John's writings, did you bring them? Are they in the back of the room or not?
I only hope my trusty crew who brought some things along.
Okay, well, it's on his website. As I indicated, he's a prominent advocate of the special envoy. Come and address that and any other issues to supplement Betty's presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Joel. After pursuing Betty for months to get her in here and asking me and then unceremoniously dumping her off the stage with these yellow cards, I can only fear that since you only asked me a couple of days ago, what do I got, 2 minutes here before you're going to knock me off? By the way, I am...
Betty took the yellow...
Yeah, I know. I told her just grab it and hide it. I'm a basketball player, not a soccer player, so yellow cards, they don't work with me. You got a technical... You know, team me up or something like that if I'm going over time. After 20-plus years of working on Africa's worst conflict zones and laboring on U.S. policy towards those zones, I've basically concluded, newsflash, that the international community's response is largely marked by the deployment of a wide variation of smoke and mirrors, with the very sincere, I think, hope and perhaps a little bit of self-deception that some of that smoke and some of those mirrors might actually make a difference in ending the crisis du jour. In Darfur, we've used the word genocide. We've subcontracted a stunningly inadequate force to observe a non-existent ceasefire and sent hundreds of millions of dollars in humanitarian aid. In Congo, we pushed for elections. We've sent a largely inadequate force to observe a ceasefire that doesn't address the core violence in the east of the country, and we've sent hundreds of millions of dollars in humanitarian aid. But in northern Uganda, we've taken our smoke and mirrors act, I think, to new heights of folly. The international community has sent no force, we've provided no meaningful support to the peace process, and we've provided less than the usual humanitarian aid. We've ignored the issue in the Security Council, but we blew a real big puff of smoke up everyone's nose late last year when the first ever ICC indictments were issued. Despite months of suspense about when those warrants would be issued, which removed any element of surprise, the ICC's global backers, most notably the Europeans, did nothing to enhance the prospects that the warrants would have any chance of execution. And the U.S. did little to counter an organization, the Lord's Resistance Army, that is on its own terrorist list and to address a conflict that threatens to undermine the peace deal in southern Sudan, as Betty said, that the U.S. heavily invested in. What sets northern Uganda apart from these other African conflicts marked by the commission of mass atrocities is the relative ease with which it could be solved with appropriate and sufficient meaningful international support. Congo has 150,000 men and boys under arms. Sudan, only slightly less than that. In northern Uganda, the LRA probably has at any given time perhaps 700 to 1,000 deployable militia. That is the scope of the threat. 19 years, the government of Uganda and the international community have watched this small-time predatory mafia displace family by family nearly every human being in the northern third of the country. That is a legacy of failure that may well be unmatchable globally. Okay, Big Mouth, I hear some of you asking, especially if there's anybody in the State Department, okay, Big Mouth, what would you do? I will tell you, but I'll preface the recommendations by saying that the preceding administration for which I toiled did jack all about this conflict when we were there. So I share directly in the culpability for this deadly non-engagement. As a good Catholic boy, Betty, this is my penance. The only chance we have, in my view, for ending the northern Uganda nightmare and providing a success for the International Criminal Court's first case is to ramp up a dual, mutually reinforcing war and peace strategy that seeks to bring much greater military pressure on the LRA at the same time as a credible exit strategy for the same LRA is created. First, let's talk about the war strategy. There's a few elements. First element in the war strategy is we got to create a credible threat to kill or capture Joseph Kony, Vincent Oti, and the other indictees. Now, you do that either by a much more focused and effective train-and-equip program for the UPDF, the Ugandan military, and the government of Southern Sudan's military, which is the SPLA, with heavy human rights conditions, or by finding one government in the entire world with qualified special forces that could deploy in close consultation with the government of Uganda one commando unit with appropriate intelligence and logistical support to undertake a hard target search for the indictees. One successful strike, either way, would have a catalytic impact, laying the groundwork for a real solution. Secondly, as part of the war strategy, you've got to deal with the cross-border aspect of this insurgency. This all can't happen within northern Uganda's borders. As you all know, it's now become a three-country crisis where the LRA crosses with impunity into Sudan and into the Congo. We need, in some variation, a hot pursuit agreement between Sudan and Congo, and particularly the government of southern Sudan and Congo and northern Uganda and Ugandan governments, and engage the two peacekeeping operations and mandate the two peacekeeping operations in Congo, Monuc, and in southern Sudan, UNMISS, to much more directly participate in the LRA's apprehension efforts. Third part of the war strategy, we got to do much more internationally to support the protection of internally displaced people in northern Uganda. Now, the government of Uganda, of course, has the primary responsibility to protect, as we all know, and it has failed in large measure to do so. So the government has to be pressured more directly to prosecute human rights violators from within its own ranks, within the UPDF, and redeploy its forces to prioritize protection of civilian populations in the north. So that's the war strategy. I think hand in glove with that needs to be a corresponding peace strategy. This young lady here, Ms. Betty Bagombe, needs meaningful international support for a comprehensive peace initiative and the resources to make it a success. I mean, 19 years, again, and we have no credible, no meaningful international strategy of support for a peace process in northern Uganda. For the LRA leadership, it's all about security guarantees and livelihood opportunities. That's it. That's the scope of their demands. That's the scope of what would be required to get a success here. Now, there are numerous components to a peace strategy. The first, and we've already heard Betty talk about a dialogue strategy that deals in some way with the indicted commanders at the NLRA, and a second track deals with the non-indicted commanders and the rank and file that follow them. There's a lot we could talk about there, but I see him preparing his yellow card, so I'm gonna roll on. The second part of that peace strategy needs the, again, just to reinforce what Betty said, because it's so crucial, is a DDR strategy, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration. People have talked a big game in this for a while. There's a few NGOs up there doing little drops in the ocean. There needs to be an overall program which is connected to a public diplomacy strategy so that the LRA in the bush knows that it exists, with serious resources, with serious livelihood opportunities for people who come out of the bush and are able to then find an alternative to the way of life that they have now within the LRA as a real incentive. And the third aspect of the peace strategy then is, again, to reinforce what she's already said, is we need envoys. We need real actors. We need people on the ground in support of Betty's work. We need a special envoy from the United Nations. We need a special envoy from the European Union and from the United States. I don't know if it should be the current envoy for Sudan. Roger has his hands full with Darfur and implementation in the southern Sudan. I think we need a presidential envoy that's sent by President Bush that focuses on addressing and resolving the crisis in northern Uganda specifically. Give President Museveni a partner for peace. He has nobody. Betty Bugambe meets him every once in a while when she's in Uganda, when she's not up in Gulu working on this, when she's in Kampala, when she's not in Gulu working on this thing. And that's really the pressure that he gets to resolve this crisis. Very inadequate, very irregular pressure from donors. No real partnership with any other external government to work on this crisis. And I've worked with President Museveni for a long time, both in government and out, and I think very, very sincerely that if he had someone from the United States, an envoy status from the president, I think that he would escalate his efforts dramatically in support of a peace deal. Now, a diplomatic strategy, of course, has to be crafted, and we're in the home stretch here, to make the war and peace strategy a success. First, the UN Security Council. This conflict is classic Security Council. There's a clear threat to international peace and security. There are commissions, crimes against humanity. There are killing of international peacekeepers. And there's destruction of life and property in three different countries. I'll leave it to your judgment as to whether this falls into the Security Council's parameters, but I certainly believe it that the Council needs to take this on and contribute constructively to the resolution of the crisis. And secondly, as part of a diplomatic strategy, heavy pressure has to be applied, particularly on the Sudanese government, but also on the Congolese government, to apprehend the indictees, to break any political connections that exist with LRA actors, to end any resupply, because the government of Sudan continues to do so through their military intelligence, and to stop providing sanctuary, which, again, the Sudan government is doing for Joseph Kony north of Juba. And sanctions should be imposed, not threatened, imposed on actors, individuals who are seen to be engaged in some way in support of the Lord's Resistance Army in either of those two governments. The good news is that it wouldn't take a whole lot to do all this that I've just outlined. There's no powerful K Street lobbying firm advocating in favor of child soldiers in Uganda like there is down the street in favor of genocide in Sudan. But there's not another lawsuit. It won't cost a lot of money. We don't need a U.S.-led invasion. We just need U.S. leadership. Our opponents are apathy, indifference, and ignorance. If we know we have the chance to help 1.5 million displaced people go home tomorrow, if we know we have the chance to liberate over 1,000 child soldiers from captivity, if we know we have a chance to end the phenomenon of night commuting that all of you know about once and for all, shouldn't we do everything we can to make it happen? Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. You raised a lot of possibilities there, which I'm sure we'll explore in the question period. Our next speaker is Catherine Southwick, who is going to focus specifically on the impact of the ICC coming into the Ugandan conflict as a result of a referral by the Ugandan government. Catherine practices international arbitration law at White & Castle here in Washington. She has spent considerable time in northern Uganda since the mid-1990s, beginning when her father was ambassador to Uganda, and subsequently during a series of internships while she was a student at Yale University and later at the Yale Law School, from which she recently graduated. She spent last summer conducting field research in Uganda as a research associate from the Refugee Law Project, which focuses on the conflict. She's published a number of articles since that experience, including an article in the Yale International Law Journal. Do I have the title right? Journal of International Affairs, of which there are some copies at the back of the room. An op-ed piece in the International Herald Tribune early this year on the complicating role of the International Criminal Court. And so without further ado, Catherine.
I haven't timed this, so you'll have to watch me. And I'm sorry to disappoint the audience if they were hoping for a panel full of controversy. I think it seems that the three of us agree on a number of things, so it's a great platform for advocacy, but it may not necessarily be a great platform for digging into the controversy here. So I'll try to do that a little bit just for the sake of argument, which I like. I will be commenting on the role of the International Criminal Court, and I need to stress at the outset that none of my comments flow from any work done by my law firm, White & Case. So since the ICC opened an investigation in mid-2004, the ICC has been one of the most important factors in this conflict. The unsealing of arrest warrants in October 2005 is certainly one of the most significant developments in the past few months. These warrants, being the first issued by the court, are historically significant, constituting one of the first concrete steps on behalf of the international community towards condemning and, it is hoped, deterring impunity for the worst crimes in the world, not just in Uganda, but worldwide. But for a young, untested institution, we should be very wary of raising expectations. Regarding northern Uganda specifically, the warrants are significant in a different way, because they have, without question, and as the panelists have addressed, complicated peace and relief efforts in northern Uganda. So this is the dilemma regarding the ICC in northern Uganda. How do we assure the success of the ICC and advance international justice, yet at the same time seek to attain the desperately needed peace in northern Uganda as soon as possible? Whether we can have both depends, I think, on how flexible we are about the meaning of the success of the ICC or what it means to advance international justice. These concepts are more open to interpretation than the latter goal, which is peace. In its most basic terms, is very objective. Either the war is over and we have a very basic measure of security, or we don't. And when I speak of how flexible we are, I really do mean we, as international observers from the media, NGOs, governments, I'm not sure who exactly is here, and universities, because I strongly believe that our opinions and our views on what international justice means and what our responsibilities are to protect civilians abroad will influence the ICC and how international will is channeled to address these goals of peace and justice. My concern is that perceptions of the ICC and how to measure its success are too narrow currently. Since the ICC opened its investigation into the situation in northern Uganda in mid-2004, northern Uganda is often portrayed as a test case for the ICC, implying that if the ICC isn't able to apprehend and prosecute its indictees, the institution will have somehow failed and disappointed us. For me, however, while prosecuting Kony and his commanders would be nice, This isn't what the test for the ICC should be about. The test should be whether the ICC legitimately and effectively employs its discretion. The chief prosecutor and the trial chamber handling this case have discretion with every decision they make or not make, whether to initiate the investigation, whether to issue arrest warrants, and whether to pursue prosecution and further down the path. I've suggested in other publications that the ICC has misused its discretion regarding Northern Uganda. As the co-panelists have indicated, there have been a number of negative consequences arising from the warrants and the investigation generally. There's been a real shift in the peace strategy. Because the ICC depends on other states to apprehend the indictees, the practical effect is to encourage the military approach to the conflict and diminish the scope for peace talks, the latter being the least costly and, if meaningfully supported, the fastest way out of this conflict. And soon after the warrants were unsealed, LRA violence intensified. Humanitarian workers were targeted and several were killed, bearing out warnings repeatedly expressed to the prosecutor by Betty Bigombe, local traditional and religious leaders, and humanitarian organizations. Humanitarian groups have initially scaled back operations in an environment where 1,000 people die per week in IDP camps and where child mortality exceeds emergency levels, as Betty mentioned. And donors, specifically the Europeans supportive of the ICC, have concurrently reduced their support for the Bigombe's initiative. I'm going to skip some of this. The military solution alone has long been identified as ineffective and, from a human rights perspective, untenable. For 20 years, the military has lacked resources and motivation and training to engage the LRA effectively. And Human Rights Watch and other groups have documented widespread army abuse of the local population. And in issuing the warrants, the ICC cannot avoid endorsing tactics which necessitate killing or wounding traumatized child captives who constitute the LRA. Let's see. And many individuals I spoke with in northern Uganda viewed the ICC investigation with suspicion and anxiety. And whatever support the ICC had after the warrants were issued quickly evaporated once the local population understood that the ICC did not have its own army and that it would not immediately bring an end to the conflict, as many had hoped. It was just more of the same. The other danger of the ICC in invoking its actions, I think, and this is something that Betty has pointed out in other talks, is that Once the warrants were issued, there was a kind of stasis in other international responses to the conflict. There was this sense of waiting and seeing what happens. Effectively, ICC actions became an excuse for others' inaction. Essentially, I think the big lesson here is to issue warrants in the context of ongoing conflict where the likelihood of arrest is so small risks condemning the war to resolution through military attrition. In northern Uganda, it has long been established that the civilians bear the brunt of this strategy. So where does this state of affairs leave us? How do we move forward? I received an email this morning from a friend working on peace building in northern Uganda, and he asked me if this panel had yielded any avenues for the way forward. We need serious discretion on the ground here. It's all very aimless at the moment. As I indicated, the likelihood of getting these guys militarily is extremely small, excepting a few lucky bullets. This strategy, as indicated by the other panelists, is perhaps to militarily pressure top commanders to seek a peace deal. And let's be honest, there can be no definitive peace deal without negotiation with the top leaders, the indictees. The question then for the ICC and moving forward is, what is its policy if this scenario plays out? If the top commanders do seek a peace deal, if they do seek third country asylum, the ICC has two options, obviously. It can pursue the prosecution, or it could defer. Under the Rome Statute, the prosecutor can defer the case under two sets of circumstances. First, the Security Council can call for a deferral for a year, passing a resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. And then second, which I think is unlikely to happen given how little attention the Security Council has paid to this issue. So really, we're left with Article 53, where the prosecutor himself can seek to defer if he determines that, quote, there is not a sufficient basis for prosecution because a prosecution is not in the interests of justice, taking account all the circumstances, including, dot, 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 the interests of victims and other factors. Problem with this article is that nobody knows what the interests of victims mean. The content of the meaning of these terms has not been established. The prosecutor, to his credit, has in the past solicited interpretations from NGOs and many others concerning the meaning of Article 53, left deliberately vague by the creators of the Rome Statute. And he has indicated that he would defer if a solution to ending the violence was found. And this wording is highly subject to interpretation, but it does indicate that he believes his mandate is constrained by progress and peace talks. So the ICC will face a tough choice, as indicated in the recent ICG report, if third country asylum is sought. Is this for me? Or no? Am I going too long? Okay, I'll keep going. I'll go quickly. So at any rate, I advocate deferral in this regard, if that's not obvious at this point. But I think what's important to sort of lessen the sense of disappointment that that recommendation has is to recognize that deferral in the interests of victims is a perfectly legitimate and respectable use of discretion under the Rome Statute. The ICC can also take credit for reinforcing peace by creating a disincentive to staying in the bush. That is, that if the indictees are captured, then they can go to the ICC, but if there is a credible peace process, then the ICC will hold off. The ICC can also take credit for encouraging regional governments to cooperate better in applying military pressure and drawing badly needed world attention to the conflict. I think it's also important to point out that the choice between peace and justice that the ICC raises is really not so stark. The underlying question here is what kinds of justice exist in the peace-building process at different moments. What is unique about northern Uganda is that the ICC isn't the only justice option. Traditional and religious leaders have emphasized reconciliation based on traditional practices, which stress accountability through admission of guilt, truth-telling, compensation, all of which are not alien concepts to other transitional justice policies in other countries. And all of these components should be strengthened. We've also seen the passage of a blanket amnesty law, which was democratically enacted in 2000, another unusual trait for an amnesty law. But I know that deferral or deference to peace efforts is a bit disappointing to international justice advocates, and it doesn't I haven't completely eliminated the quandary here, but this is the nature of compromise and transitional justice, what some professors have identified as the pragmatic balancing of ideal justice with political realism. To the extent that the ICC is going to involve itself in situations where conflict is ongoing, we may need a different way of thinking about law, and that it can't be as consistently and uniformly applied as we would like in a domestic system. Flexibility is necessary, and we should be prepared for it. The ICC will have to treat each case differently, but there are certain principles that can shape the ICC's discretion or factors to consider, which, number one, the ability to execute arrest warrants, the wishes of victims, the advice of experts on the situation, in particular, a situation where you have a chief mediator working for peace at great personal risk and sacrifice, in constituting what experts have identified as the best opportunity for peace since the war began. And finally, let me return to our international expectations. I think it's just important that we give the prosecutor room to be cautious and to acknowledge that the ICC is in a difficult position, but compromising immediate results for the ICC is far better for the ICC in the long run than compromising further the lives of the 2 million people in northern Uganda. Thank you.
Catherine, that was really an excellent and succinct discussion, not only of the particular case, but the more general issues of the ICC that will be applicable elsewhere. Well, as any good set of presentations often happens, there are a host of questions that have been raised in my mind that are food for thought for the next hour. Steve, would you like to have first crack since you have to exit? And then we can move more generally to the other people in the room. Just talk and raise your voice.
My reaction is just to push back here is listening to presentations, just a few very strong cautionary notes. One is we have to be very intellectually honest about what the real realities are and the real opportunities for action. Special envoys are a trap. They're an angel dust that's rolled out periodically as a fix. We have to be very clear on what they're supposed to be doing and what the strategy is. And I don't see a strategy emerging out of this. I don't think there are any good options. There are no quick fixes on this. And there's a lot of confusion out there in terms of competing agendas and competing constituencies that are mobilized around this issue. When you look at the broader canvas of hard choices in Sudan and Ethiopia and elsewhere that are dominating attention, this issue will continue to be a second or third rank, third tier issue. It's one where the ICC is playing a big new role, quite uncertain what the impact is. Negotiations are stalled. Yosemite's heading into an election process. Very conflicted and very ambiguous signals about what his real intentions are with respect to this. And the regional players themselves, not clear how you engage them. The Security Council, not clear what its real equities are to play here. And, you know, Washington, understandably, is not racing to the fore in the middle of all of this confusion to own this conflict. And so let's avoid feel-good utopianism around this conflict. Just saying it's a morally compelling case doesn't get you there. Saying there are quick fixes doesn't get you there. We have to have a much clearer and honest discussion of what the real choices are and how do you sell those choices to an administration and to a set of constituents here in the United States that are pulling us in pretty different directions. I think you need, if you want to get a higher profile here in Washington on this, it's far better to say, here are the emergent opportunities and here is an incremental process and here is a strategy. I don't hear any strategy coming out right now as to what can be gained by dramatically stepping up diplomatic engagement right now on this. The negatives are pretty high in confusion.
Maybe you want to respond first and then John.
Oh no, you can't take several questions.
This is a very specific issue. I'd like to have this addressed. I might add, what type of person would the special envoy be? I mean, John, you
don't add. Let's answer Steve's question, Joel. That's very, very key. Thanks.
I would probably start by asking you some questions. What strategy it took to get Sudan, Darfur, if you will, to get special envoy? What strategy it took for Congo and now and Rwanda, the Great Lakes region? It took to get them to get special envoy. Here we are talking of a situation, a forgotten war that has gone on for years. We're talking of over 1 million people in camps. We're talking of thousands of children being abducted. We're talking of deaths in camp, not direct result of war, but because of the terrible humanitarian situation. First of all, what has finally gotten the UN to have special envoy, even the U.S. government to have special envoy in Sudan, is that the visibility of the situation that with the press, with special envoy, the international community is being briefed all the time on the terrible situation and with suggestions of what should be done. I talked earlier on the threat to the regional stability in the area. I talked about the incursion of LRA into Sudan, making it basically impossible for the peace process to be implemented. At the moment, in southern Sudan, people cannot be resettled because LRA continues to kill and abduct and loot whatever little properties they have. In fact, I was talking to somebody in Uganda yesterday who were telling me an area where the entire community in southern Sudan has fled because they fear LRA is advancing into that region, into the area. So if we're going to step back and say, let's have let's leave the investment for the peace process in Sudan slip away because we do not have special strategy, I think we're wasting opportunity where we could start working on the strategy to persuade high-level representatives in the region. I do not know whether you want
Does
to...
Does that mean, Betty, that the SPLM or the government of southern Sudan is now prepared to make the case that she can stop home, that there needs to be, in order to consolidate its own peace, that there needs to be
a much
higher, higher engagement with respect to the LRA and the disruptions that they're experiencing?
Their feeling is that... I talked to several generals from southern Sudan. Their feeling is that at least there should be somebody, international force, if you will, to monitor and track down LRA's movement in southern Sudan. Because in one respect, there is allegation that support still goes to LRA from the government of Uganda, of Sudan. There ought to be a watchdog. At the moment, nobody has that mandate to follow movement of LRA. But if you have a person specifically designated to track down movement, to see any kind of support that is going to LRA, certainly it will receive international attention and be addressed that way.
I've never inhaled angel dust, Steve, but it seems to me that despite that clear difference, there is a strategy there in place that could be introduced rather cheaply and without a whole lot of political will that would make a very big difference. It really is a political will issue, and we use that term all the time, but it is nowhere sort of more clear than here in the case of Uganda. It is a choice. The deal in southern Sudan is threatened by the LRA. The government of Sudan uses militias to undermine opposition and undermine peace processes. And when the militias that it tries to rely on in southern Sudan, principally from the Nuer communities and some from Equatoria, are going to be diminished over the next 6 years as they become invested in the oil wealth and other things, then I think we're going to see a continuing reliance on the part of the government of Sudan to use the LRA to undermine cohesion in the south in order to undermine any prospect that a referendum will be held in 6 years. If any of us in this room believe that this ruling party in Sudan is going to allow the referendum to occur 6 years from now on an area where the majority of the oil is, we're in dreamland. We are on angel dust. It is in the strategic interest, as we subjectively define it, that the United States engage in northern Uganda, because it is in our strategic interest to encourage the implementation of a peace deal that we, as a government, worked assiduously over two administrations and will continue to work over the next one to ensure that it's implemented. Now, you said there needs to be a reason. I think that's a good reason. You said there needs to be we need to present the opportunity. There is an opportunity. The LRA rear bases have been destroyed over the last year and a half. They're highly stratified, small groups of militia that float around and do damage. I think this is an opportunity at this point militarily to deal this organization a death blow at a minimal cost without a huge application of military assets. Thirdly, you asked, well, then you need to present a strategy. Again, I think the strategy is quite obvious. We need to ramp up those military efforts marginally, incrementally, to make a difference. We need to pursue a counterinsurgency strategy, not just a conventional war strategy. The Ugandan government has not reorganized its forces in the north sufficiently to address the kind of threat that a smaller, more mobile, more decentralized LRA presents to the people of the north. So pursuing a counterinsurgency strategy that marries intelligence with special forces, with the logistics to allow those special forces to close in pursuit on the basis of real intelligence, real-time intelligence, is what's needed. They don't have it. It doesn't exist. There's been a little training by the United States that is not empowered a commando unit to do what we're talking about. We give them hot information and they don't use it because there's not the political will nor the trained capacity to go after these guys, and therefore they run scot-free. We know where they are a lot of the times when they're using these phones and radios. So I think giving capacity to the UPDF and SPLA to undertake one commando unit on both sides of the border to do precisely that, to close on targets, to create the intelligence capacity that's shared in real time, we will be able to provide a great deal more pressure on the LRA than presently exists, and to the extent possible, UNMISS and MONUC can be brought into that equation. And, you know, they have other huge, pressing mandates and objectives, so I don't think we should divert them from their main task. But certainly in providing transport and intelligence as well, they can be helpful. And the reason to do the military strategy is to reinforce the possibility of an exit option for the LRA through this effort here. And the exit option is a real one. I think, as Catherine pointed out, third country asylum will become much more appealing to the five indictees if there is a credible threat that they will be killed. And I think that for the non-indictees, if we have a substantial DDR program in place that allows for livelihoods and security, they'll leave the bush. There's nothing in it for them. There was a lot in it for the LRA for years because they build up these small-time fiefdoms with their dozens of wives and their the money that they gained by looting properties in southern Sudan and northern Uganda. But this has largely been destroyed in the context of the destruction of the rear bases. So they have an incentive to come out of the bush. We just got to create the avenue to do it.
John, let me just ask one follow-up here on special forces. First of all, whose special forces? Ours, and is that really realistic? And does not your prescription in some way point to a contradiction in your answer to Steve's previous question, and that is the extent of political will on the part of the Ugandan government, and particularly the UPDF, to bring the war to a close? It's been going on for 19 years. There are people who have profited from that war. The army is a pillar of the Museveni regime. There's a broader political context here than simply what's going on in the north.
Yeah, the special forces, which I was just talking about, would be rapidly trained and equipped elements of the UPDF and the SPLA. I also think that we ought to have beat the bushes and talk to President Museveni about the possibility of deploying and seeing whether there is a third country that would be willing to provide 50 to 100 troops to support, to undertake for a short time these kinds of operations while basically on-the-job training for UPDF and SPLA. Can we find 100 troops throughout in the entire world for this objective? And would the president of Uganda accept it? I don't know. It requires some political will. But it was discussed in the Security Council over the last couple of days. So we'll see what happens. At least people are starting to talk about it. Regarding the political will issue, which is very important, I don't think sufficient political will exists to undertake the kind of military operations necessary to bring the LRA insurgency to an end currently within the Ugandan government. That's why we need a special envoy. That's why the U.S. has to make it clear to President Museveni that it matters to us that this war ends. Let's create a partnership to do it. Because I don't think waving our finger at him once every few months or having quiet meetings, and if it's business as usual, the embassy can be crucial. But President Museveni knows that if he's just being demarched from ambassador, that's not enough. I think he needs, from my experience with him, he needs to have that extra push that comes from Washington where somebody comes out and this is their objective, to end one of the worst wars in the world.
I simply want to emphasize what John said earlier on, is that let's give President Museveni a partner to help him fight this war. It's not enough to simply go sit back and say, well, you know, Ugandan army is benefiting from the war, without trying to see how can President Museveni be supported to stop Ugandan army benefiting from the war and therefore wanting the war to continue. Something ought to happen to bring all these things, the observations we make, or suspicions that we have that things are not going the wrong way. It's not enough to sit back and talk about it and not try to do something about it. I think giving him a partner, making him realize that the international community is concerned, has realized that the war has dragged on for so long, despite the promises of military solution. And therefore, something else ought to happen that can probably reinforce Ugandan army. It's just like what Catherine said a little earlier on. People are so disappointed that ICC has simply given Ugandan army a piece of paper to go and arrest or kill Kony when it has been the task of UPDF to do so for the last 19 years. So I guess what I'm trying to say in here is that it's not enough to just talk about the weaknesses. It's time to be more proactive and see how, like John is suggesting, how about training SPLA and Ugandan army to make them more efficient and more effective. That probably would help the conflict rather than just talking about the weaknesses, which true, they do exist. Thank you.
David Chin.
David Chin, George Washington University. This is directed to many or each of you. If you can, by way of background, the LRA is not the first dissident or extremist organization in northern Uganda. It's probably not the last. Looking beyond the LRA, let's assume for the moment that somehow this is dealt with, can you suggest the kinds of things, the kinds of programs that the United States should be engaged in northern Uganda to deal with the broader issue of extremism? What works? What is needed in this part of the world in order to grapple with a bigger problem that looks beyond the LRA?
We talked about the reintegration of former combatants who, at the moment, there's really no visible program that can give them a means of livelihood. Not only that, when you have over 12,000 former ex-combatants who have known only violence, who have been extremely brutal, not being catered for, being left on their own, what kind of situation do you expect? That's going to be insecurity. So the DDR program is one of priority areas that support is needed immediately. We are not only looking at turning them to be productive members of the community, but we are also trying to deal with a time bomb, in that sooner or later, there's still lots of weapons around in that area, either within northern Uganda or in southern Sudan, where so many of them can walk back and pick them up. And my fear, too, when I talk about insecurity that this poses at the moment, that there's no reintegration program, is that it's also a fertile ground for dissidents to go and recruit. And sometimes I even go further to say that even terrorists will find it a fertile ground to go and recruit, because these are people who have nothing to lose. They've seen it all, they've done it, and they're happy to do it again if somebody is ready to give them $100. So looking at looking at the DDR program as one of the priority areas, it's also, I said earlier and I will repeat, in that it can act as a pull factor to attract all these other LRAs who are not indicted to come out. Secondly, it's reconciliation. Reconciliation is one of the areas that is very necessary, because community have not yet been properly prepared to receive former LRAs. There is hostility being exhibited. Within the last 2 months, there have been occasions when community went to burn down, to burn dead bodies of LRA. Now, that sends a message to LRAs who are still out there. What kind of community can we come to if the hostility is at this level, where they even burn dead bodies, or where they have flogged dead bodies? What kind of community can they turn to? Furthermore, you have reconciliation within households. Sometimes I look at the small interventions that are small interventions by mainly NGOs and civil society organizations. What you would like to see is coherence. To bring coherence to these interventions so that they can make an impact. At the moment, most of the interventions, whether it's on peace building, reconciliation program, or rehabilitating child mothers, everybody is doing their own little thing and nobody is coordinating it. But having the U.S. come into the area of DDR will also get government will wake up and come in and coordinate the kind of interventions. At the moment, everything is everywhere. There's no coordination that is being provided. So you don't see the impact. A lot of it is spending programs as opposed to the impact, as opposed to programs that are targeting a group in a comprehensive manner and bearing good results. So,
could you say something about NUPI in this regard? I thought NUPI was supposed to address some of these very issues.
I need to. It's true that NUPI is working on some reconciliation program, but NUPI has concentrated more on the bigger picture. NUPI is looking at reconciliation between districts, because the war definitely has affected other tribes, neighboring tribes, and therefore NUPI is trying to get people from West Nile to get together with people from Acholi, people from Lango and Teso to reconcile. I'm talking about reconciliation that goes into households. We have parents whose children were abducted. Their daughters have come back with the rebels, with the commander's children. The parents feel extremely uncomfortable having these children remain in their homes. I'm talking about community, the children who have been abducted, after abduction, their first assignment is go back home and kill members of your own community, including members of your own family. These children have nowhere to go. They're trying to cope with the situation. I'm looking at the reconciliation program that starts right from household level to community level and works its way up. But what NUPI is doing is concentrating to a large extent on at the district level. We need micro reconciliation programs.
Okay.
Okay. 30 seconds on that.
30 seconds, because there's
three things. That's the short to medium term agenda. The longer term agenda, Dave, is I think long term development planning for resettlement. The resettlement patterns of 1.7 million, whatever people, is going to be very chaotic, terribly compromised. And there needs to be some very serious planning done now. Secondly, good governance. Nobody's ever invested in governance in the North, in decentralizing authority to the North, taxing powers, and really creating institutions that serve people's interests. And at least putting some investment into that is critical. And then third is participation, ensuring that in the post-election government that Northerners are fully involved in that government going forward.
Yeah, thank you for that particular last point of the political dimension of this. Now, in the back, you've been waiting very patiently. Could you identify yourself, please?
Sure. Brielle Dawson from the National Impact Institute. Following up on that issue of the elections, we all know that the Dallas elections are taking place in presidential, parliamentary, and local elections in February, with the first of these slated for February 23rd. And I'm curious to know if the opinions of the panelists on the extent to which the elections represent an opportunity or pose a threat to the prospect of peace in the Union. We also know that there are now 6 international donors that have suspended some component of their aid program because, and citing largely government, the manner in which you can handle the transition. And I'd just be interested to hear as to whether the panelists would think of maybe that channel using the incentive that international donors have already seemed to demonstrate that the benefit of the for the region.
Yeah, I've asked John to go first.
Surrogate answer here. I think that the elections, for those that are focused on trying to address the issues in the North, the elections have posed a bit of a problem in the sense that it's delayed everything. I think there really isn't, the only game in town now is who's going to win this thing. So in the aftermath of those elections, and it is not an election issue, by the way, as any of us know who travel central and southern, it's remarkable that a third of the country's on fire and it's not even, nobody even brings it up. So except for the Northerners who are preaching to the choir, to their own audiences, and they're completely unable to deliver then whatever they're promising. So I think that what the idea is to let this tidal wave pass, electoral tidal wave pass, and then get back on the horse and ride back in a bigger way. I think that what Betty has done over the last couple of months is spent a lot of time talking to American officials and UN personnel about how such a strategy that we've talked about today can be deployed in the aftermath of those elections with the hopes that they will go relatively smoothly and with the hopes that there'll be some elements of fairness to them. And I think that the opportunity exists after the elections. I don't think anything can be done now, but the opportunity exists after the elections to reengage the president and to deploy an incrementally but not insignificantly increased international support for the kinds of elements that we're talking about today, particularly the diplomatic element, if the Security Council engages, if there is some meaningful support for a diplomatic option, if a little bit more can be done on the military side, then there is a real chance to use the post-election environment to move the situation forward in northern Uganda.
Just to supplement, 30 seconds. I have been watching and following very, very closely the campaigns to hear if any of the candidates will come up with a very clear agenda for northern Uganda. My hope was that the campaigns would be yet another opportunity to hear clearly what programs, for example, President Museveni has for northern Uganda. All I've heard is that the war will end by March. And so as something being promised during the campaigns, that really does not give me any hope that the elections will have any bearing, change anything in the war situation. I've been trying to also follow from the opposition side What do they have to offer for Northern Uganda? As some people have retorted back, said, well, some of you members of the opposition were part of the government, part of the problem. So what is new that you're going to offer besides saying that when we come into power, we'll make sure the war ends? How are you going to end it? By dialogue? How are you going to attract coin? I've not been able to hear that. So my fear is that we're losing an opportunity where we could possibly hold political leaders to their word that this is what you promised. And we hope you can deliver when and if you assume office. Unfortunately, Northern Uganda has taken a back burner. I feared this was going to happen, and it is happening, because as we've said earlier on, LRA is not active. Consequently, people are able to move around. Campaigns is going on in Northern Uganda just as much as it's going on in other parts of the country. So that compounds my fear that even after the elections, it will be business as usual.
Well, I thought of this as a point of leverage, the elections being a point of leverage for the international quartet countries specifically that were focused on Northern Uganda, who had been so disappointed by Museveni's behavior in the past year with respect to third term and so forth. I had wondered whether or if these governments might consider conveying to Museveni somehow in a nice way that, you know, this has been disappointing. You know, this has been going on for 10 years. But maybe if you make some progress in Northern Uganda, you can rehabilitate your reputation with us. And maybe we'll start redirecting our aid back more directly to Uganda. Like in the case of the British government, they pulled their aid out and rechanneled it towards Northern Uganda peace efforts. So I wonder if this might be a point of leverage for some of these governments.
If I can't resist commenting here, I've written on this and I thought I'd keep my mouth shut today. Look, there is a massive amount of aid. I think you all know that over half the budget of the government of Uganda is provided by the international donor community. That is the main pressure point, particularly budget support, which is provided by the World Bank, the British, who, as Catherine has just noted, I think in a very significant move, has not reduced aid to Uganda so much as it's reprogrammed it away from simply putting cash in the treasury of President Museveni, which he has used to not only support the government in general, but build up his military, create a Praetorian Guard of over 10,000 men, et cetera, et cetera. There is a political dimension here that involves the army. And frankly, after 19 years, if you bet on the Uganda Army, retrained or not, I think you're whistling in the dark. This is why I asked the question about whose special forces and what kind of pressure can be applied, whether it's a combination of aid reductions in the future because the current reductions are largely symbolic, or just heavy diplomatic involvement. And I would agree. The embassy out there, our embassy, I think, has done a wonderful job. Certainly the reporting back has been accurate. We know what's going on. I think the problem is actually here in D.C. that this issue does not gain traction at a high enough level. Herb, you had Herb Weiss, you had your hand raised for a while, and then maybe we'll take a cluster first and see whether they come together. Herb?
Herbert Wise for the Woodrow Wilson Center. Two questions to David Gombe. What are the sort of natural allies, cousins of the Acholi, if any, in the DRC? And independently of that, is the LRA, to your knowledge, in alliance with any of the militia groups in eastern DRC?
Okay. Next question, if we may. I'll take three.
Mike Pop, Murder Uganda Campaign. My question kind of relates back to one that was previously asked about the marginalization of the North and the very looming potential for the development of future insurgencies. and particularly relating to the role that the community in the North plays in determining these kinds of decisions and processes that are made about the war. You have the ICC that didn't consult with the population at all about its role. You have international NGOs that are providing all of the assistance to the camps. You have the government that clearly does not heed the voice of people in the North. My question would be, are there ways that they can be engaged as stakeholders in these decision-making processes that would also facilitate the future empowerment and the future reconciliation of the country, as well as, you know, how would that affect, you know, efforts to end the war and gain sustainable peace?
And David Thrupp to finish on this side of the room.
David Thrupp, yes. It's more an observation than a question. I've worked on Uganda on and off about 15 years. And during those 15 years, nothing very much seems to have changed. So that we had the 1996 election, the North was put on the back burner, the peace effort had just failed, there was possibility of progress perhaps immediately after the election. I think we've got to realize that it is not in the interests at the moment, or again, say, in the last 19 years, of the government of Uganda to solve the problem of the Uganda. Betty Chikonge knows this, I suspect. The rug has been pulled up underneath her twice, in 1994 and 2004, essentially by the government of Uganda. The Ugandan government has created an economically useful zone in the south and has completely marginalized and isolated the north. Provides justification in the early 90s and again today for extremely high military expenditure. 40% of the Ugandan budget, 50% of which is provided by the international donor community, goes on military expenditure. That military expenditure is not spent on UPDF in the north. Anybody who has gone around UPDF facilities in the north knows how abysmal they are. The money is used partly for corruption, partly for other activities by the Ugandan government. It is not spent in the north. The Ugandan government, I suspect, could defeat the LRA any moment it wanted to, if it were actually to deploy its Praetorian Guard in the north. It's a question of political will. It is more useful for Museveni, and I suspect it's more useful for most southern Ugandans to actually forget about the war and to concentrate economic development and progress in the south. And until you grapple with that question, which is the fundamental political will and political calculations of President Museveni, by mobilizing international pressure and by really doing something about donor finance sustaining the Ugandan government, I don't think that political calculation is likely to change. It hasn't changed at any moment in the last 19 years. There is no reason for it to change now.
And sadly, the window of opportunity on the third term issue has passed with us basically being silent. Thank you for the observation. I think, Betty, you want to respond to Herb's question and the previous question about reconciliation within the communities in the north.
The Acholis do not share a common border with any tribe in the DRC. However, there's one ethnic group, the Alus, where we speak the same dialect. Mm. You have one group of Alus in Uganda and the other one in DRC. Unlike where you have a Acholis of Sudan and you have a Acholis of Uganda. Now, so personally, well, to the best of my knowledge, they do not have any allies in the DRC. The reason for relocation was apparently, the idea was hatched some 4 or 5 years ago, that some LRAs should relocate to DRC to link up with another dissident group, ADF, Allied Defense Forces. which is operates mainly in eastern Congo. And apparently, that was the time that Uganda was in DRC. I mean, Uganda government, Uganda troops were in DRC. And this was supposed to have been done with the help of the government of Sudan. But then came the protocol between the government of Uganda and Sudan, which gave birth to Operation Iron Fist. So the moment you and the U.S. government put a lot of pressure on Sudan to agree to sign to sign that protocol. Now, the moment that protocol was signed, the idea of relocating part of LRA so that they could join up with ADF and other dissident groups in DRC was frozen. Now, the recent relocation appears to have been a reactivation of that arrangement. But it's become very, very complex because there's some individuals involved that persuaded LRA that they would get support on the other side. So, but to the best of my knowledge, that link has not taken place. But nevertheless, they remain, part of them still remain in DRC.
Do you want to respond to the other question?
The second question was
Reconciliation within communities of the North, that was your question?
Basically, how can the communities be engaged as stakeholders in this process and part of the decision-making?
Well, in this particular process, the peace process that I've been involved in, I have tried as much as possible to involve the community. You cannot go to every individual and group. My the intermediary has been the religious leaders and the traditional chiefs, whom from time to time I've tried to explore comparative advantage they bring to the peace process and how they can make the community part of the peace process. But you know, in a situation where people are so preoccupied with survival, that where are you going to get your next meal from? Or where are you going to get just a simple item like soap or salt? That becomes secondary. Their full participation in the peace process is not their priority at the moment, especially women. You try as much as you can, but at the end of the day, they have these concerns of just survival, how they can go through one day. That, yes, they will participate when they can come for meetings, but don't expect them to be regular until the situation improves. That takes us directly to the issue of, you know, humanitarian assistance. You have some camps where humanitarian assistance goes once in 3 months. And even then, the portion would not last 2-3 days. It's very, very little. So to get them actively involved, you need to have improved humanitarian assistance. The health of the children are taken care of. Education concerns also collectively addressed. And that's what I would call comprehensive humanitarian assistance needs to be considered, that, so that the package can give them opportunity to do other things, like get more actively involved in the peace process.
Our time is almost up. We'll take one more round of questioning from this side of the room. I want to ask, though, one question before we do, primarily for Catherine, and that is, in respect to the ICC, what are the prospects, if any, of Kony being persuaded and the others who have been indicted being persuaded to move to a third country that is not a signatory to the ICC? What steps have been taken to perhaps pursue that avenue? Betty, you may want to comment. Well, all three of you may want to comment on that. Is that a viable opportunity? And what has been done, if anything, in this regard up till now?
I think I'd prefer if Betty comments first, and then I can comment on the ICCs and the international response or interpretation of that?
Well, I can only tell you what happened before the arrest warrant was warrants were issued. That I also did explore that possibility with ICC. One moment, they said, before the arrest warrant was issued, we did have a look at what flexibility there is within the Rome Statute. And we realized that if there was real progress then in the peace process, and Uganda government saw it fit, it could. There is room for Uganda government to call off the investigation. But since the arrest warrant has been, and therefore explore if LRA so wishes to go into exile, then that possibility could be explored. But because the arrest warrant came sooner than we had anticipated, all these options have not been discussed.
I think when the warrants complicate the prospects for a third country asylum, because I'm concerned that we'll end up with a Charles Taylor-like situation where we'll have an outstanding, you know, indictment, and the country that is hosting the exilees are under considerable international pressure to release or to hand over those exiles. I'm not sure at this point whether any country would want to put itself in that position. And the question then is, you know, how do we, I mean, this sounds so realpolitik, but I don't think of myself this way, but anyway. but how do you spin the idea of exile within the discourse of human rights if you emphasize that exile is necessary for peace and for restoring any sense of human dignity to the region of northern Uganda, if you interpret exile itself to be a form of punishment in that it, you know, in some ways, exile to some countries would be, you know, materially worse than prison in Europe. So I think it's very much something that is, again, like I was saying, shaped by what the international NGO community really, how it really responds to the option of exile and whether or not it allows scope for it.
Two final questions in the back, and then you in the front.
Paul Simon with Human Rights Watch. Peace negotiators at times have observed that in the same way as a credible military threat impacts upon the fluidity of the negotiations, that the threat of prosecution can be the same. And I wanted to find out what the impact has been internally within the LRA in terms of the dynamics between the indictees and the non-indictees, and also whether it has made the LRA less introverted organization, in terms of thinking about what the implications of the action are internationally.
Are these two questions along the same line, or are they separate?
This is a separate question.
Yours? Similar? Okay, then let's have the response so we can finish off on the ICC issue.
First of all, you need to know that LRA is a very strange rebel group. In fact, I said earlier on that there's that spiritual element that we've never paid attention to, whether it's militarily, whether it can be factored into military option or not, or whether the peace factor. I'll stray off a little bit to the question, because to some extent, the spiritualism has sustained the war because Coin apparently has predicted so many situations and they've come true. So you have his senior commander's children totally believe that he has that natural, supernatural power. Secondly, besides the spiritualism, the other thing that has sustained the war is the fact that these children are abducted from camps or homes where they can't even afford a meal a day. And suddenly Coin takes them, trains them, they fight, they've seen how he's predicted situations, and they've come true, and they believe he will one day become the president of Uganda. And if he becomes the president of Uganda, that means they're going to be rich. That means there's now opportunity for them to get away from that poverty. So they will fight to continue. They will fight as long as it takes. Now, it is a group that does, it's cut off the ordinary soldiers or even middle-level to low-level commanders. They're not even supposed to listen to news, to know what exactly is going on. Whatever is going on is coming in. They're fed by Kony and his senior commanders. One thing I can tell you is that Oti, the number two, appeared to be quite worried about ICC. And what other, I mean, we discussed back and forth a lot, options they do have, given that the arrest warrant had been issued, to a point that he even wanted to know, to learn something maybe from the chief prosecutor. His first reaction was very angry. This is an internal matter. Why get involved in it? So whether it has caused, they, like the population generally, believed that ICC was going to go probably with its own army, and that probably will make a difference in the war. But when they realize that it's the same old folks who have been entrusted with the responsibility of arresting them, that allayed their fears to some extent. So at one time they appeared very concerned, and then that was when I was pushing in, you know, this opportunity still exists, but very, very tight. So you can use it. And that is, start by declaring unilateral ceasefire. It might make a difference. But how much the others know is very difficult to know. A lot of them are kept away from such information.
Final two questions over here.
David Post, I'm a PhD student in Georgetown. My question is this. It seems through the DDR program, you obviously have to provide incentives to get people to come out from the bush. At the same time, you have a situation in northern Uganda where they can barely put food on the table. My question is, will it be necessary to undertake a regional rebuilding process in northern Uganda prior to the DDR program? Because it seems to me that this DDR program is really about community building, and until you have a community that's willing to interact with those coming home, it seems like it would be problematic for a solution to be reached. So my question is, what's the sequencing that needs to take place in order for, in terms of DDR and regional rebuilding process?
Question was very along very similar lines, and I just want to add that you've talked about...
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry, Brooks from CARE. You talked about it as a very sort of clear carrot and stick strategy, and if we're talking about the pull factor of using the DDR programming to get the LRA back into, you know, offering them livelihoods, when the common people don't have any livelihoods, and, you know, 90% of the population is in IDP camps, I mean, what foreseeable way do you see to extend the, you know, life of the people in order to create a legitimate pull factor as opposed to sort of an artificial one?
I'll start with the last question, possibly. You're very right, because a lot of times we get carried away and talk only about LRA, to a point, the reintegration of LRA, and totally ignoring victims, their victims, and ignoring people in camps. So to some extent, it could easily be interpreted that, you know, we are dying to reward LRA and not worry about their victims or the communities, people in IDP camps. We indeed, at some point when we were trying, before the arrest warrant was issued, and I was working with the governments of Norway, Britain, USA, and Netherlands. The whole idea was that if LRA is going to be supported by it, supported in any way, there was absolutely need to support members of the community and the victims in particular, because that's one way of bringing reconciliation too. But we reached it, there was then this problem that how do you define victims? Where do you draw a line? I am sitting here. I'm a victim because I've lost members of my family. I have so many orphans to support as a result of the war. So who do you leave out and who do you not leave out? So that brought some bit of problem. And indeed, when you talk to members of the international community, the feeling is that, well, if we're going to have LRA roam the street, start killing people and abduct, then let's address their situation first. But is there a way also where we can persuade LRA in a nice manner so that it doesn't look like forced labor, that they can give something back to the community during this process? It is the nuts and bolts of how this can be done that is under discussion. I do not think realistically you can do much also about besides the humanitarian assistance being received at the moment, and plus government now trying to decongest some camps so that some people can go home and try to supplement what they get through producing some food. There's not much you can do to improve the situation besides what the international community is providing in terms of humanitarian assistance. But I do clearly see your point. But the community themselves are also scared of these people who are not provided for, who might turn against them and hurt them in some ways.
Yeah. John, you wanted to make a final comment?
Just a quick second. I think employing our no angel dust snorted here policy, there are limited funds. We can't do everything. We love to have a huge, big development program that would create livelihoods for 2 million people in northern Uganda. It isn't going to happen. Steve would have been proud of me for that. People are in IDP camps because of LRA attacks. We need to stop the bleeding as the priority, I think, with what little small money we can squeeze out of the international system. Create a strategy to treat the wound immediately. Get the LRA out of the bush, or at least provide incentives to do that, and do all that we can to raise funds for the larger development strategy. But at the same time, DDR strategy have a long now history and experience in not individualizing, but creating community-based DDR programs. And I don't think it's really an either-or thing. I think there is a lot of experience. There are professionals in the bank and UNDP that have been doing this for years now and trying to widen the net of people who benefit from the return, and that's the only way that will work in northern Uganda.
I want to thank all the panelists for coming. I want to thank you for coming. This has been a long session, and I think the topic, obviously, that you've all stayed shows that importance, at least in our minds. The question is, though, still remains how we put this up higher on the policy agenda. Thank you, Betty. Thank you, John. Thank you, Catherine. Safe trip home to Uganda.